growing up here and being here doing the transition, I routinely say, if you dropped me out of the sky and asked me where was I wouldn't have a clue. Because it's so different from growing up, where we had very low-rise buildings, where development was very slow, where we had, especially after the riots of 68, where we had vacant lots all over the place.
This episode of Asbury UMC DC Oral Histories, featuring interviews from Asbury United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. These episodes are drawn from oral histories of members of one of Washington's historic black churches. Asbury has been at the corner of 11th and K Streets Northwest since its founding in 1836. These church members share their personal experiences with black history, national history, and the history of the Washington, D.C. area. This episode will feature Cardell Richardson, a Washingtonian, Howard University graduate, and longtime civil servant. After 26 years in the military, he had served for more than a decade at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, where he was Inspector General at the time of his interview. In this conversation from 2018 with interviewer Pandit Wright, he discusses memories of growing up in the District of Columbia, serving across the globe in the Air Force, and changes he's seen in Washington since the 1960s. We start with Cardell Richardson's memories of his earliest days in the city and the influence of his parents.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. Been a D.C. resident all my life, well until going into the military. But yeah, in the early days, born and raised, came home from George Washington University Hospital. I lived in that same house my entire life until I graduated Howard University and went into the military. And in those days, it was a little bit unusual to be born and raised and grow up in the same house and not move around. But very fond memories of D.C. and Asbury United Methodist Church. As a matter of fact, after growing up and having multiple experiences since 26 years in the military and subsequent to that, there are two things that feel extremely familiar to me, very just right. One is my family, because they've been constant, and two is Asbury. I know people at Asbury I've known my entire life. They've known me my entire life. And so Asbury is family, and that certainly is a large part of my growing up. My dad was a very disciplined person, my mother as well. And I hate to say, is, you know, my dad passed when I was only 11 years old. Probably the most influential person in my life, quite frankly, was my mother. Because when I was 11, she had to be both mother and father. We didn't miss a beat as a result. And because she was also so incredibly disciplined. But also, both of them were very, they were very disciplined about church and Christianity and doing the right thing. And so that did have an impact on me. I think that's why the military so resonated with me, because of the values that I learned at home I found in the military. Integrity first, service before self, and excellence in everything that you do. Those are Air Force values, but I realized those were my personal values that I learned from home, from my mother and my father. So it resonated. So some of the very same things that I had to do in the military, discipline, appreciating, recognizing, giving respect to authority, those were all values that I learned at home.
Now, you grew up in turbulent times.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of that. What do you remember, starting earliest and then continuing forward?
Here's what I remember very vividly. I was in eighth grade. It was 1968, and spring of 68, and as fate would have it, Martin Luther King was killed. We were released early from school, but because I did grow up in a disciplined household where it was very important that work ethic was something I learned from both my parents, my mom and dad. I had a part-time job, and it was way up 16th Street. It was a Webster all-girl college, a female, a women's college, and got on the bus to go to my part-time job that evening. And this story is about work ethic. Riots were happening all over U Street. I was on a bus that the bus driver had us to get off the bus at 16th and U. I had to, but I knew I had to go to work. So I walked all the way up to 16th and Calamar. Got to work. Really, no one expected that I would be there. And we actually, it was myself and another guy that worked up there, we wound up having to stay up there that evening because that evening when we left work, we got on 16th Street and we actually got, we were shot at.
Oh my.
Yeah. So we actually had to run down the alley back to Webster College. They put us up for the night.
How old were you again?
I was, I had just turned 14. Turned 14 in March. This was in April. And called mom, told her that I was okay. And so came home the next day. Likewise, we get on 16th Street. We couldn't even catch a cab. No one would pick myself and this other guy I was with, a couple years older than I was, but also African American. So we walked all the way home to 5th and L Street Northeast. But here's what I remember as we walked past Mount Vernon Square, you know, right there not far from Asbury. Remember how pungent the smell of tear gas was from the day before. And when I finally got to, when I got home, and all of the neighborhood stores, all the stores on 8th Street, the haberdashers and department stores had been rioted, had been looted. And during the riots, they had been looted. And it was just an incredible, it was just a very turbulent time in America.
How did you feel as a 14-year-old seeing your neighborhood and this change? How did you feel?
Times were changing. It was pretty radical. I got to tell you, probably without a doubt, the most, I think when I realized anything could happen to anybody, anytime, was when my dad died, some 3 years previous. So it sort of numbed me to really what could happen. So really what I was really thinking is, what does the future really portend for blacks, for people in general, when you take a peacemaker like Martin Luther King and someone would so violently gun him down. So I think it was a rude awakening for everybody, and certainly a 14-year-old, but for anybody.
Cardell Richeson goes on to talk about his high school years, where he developed an interest in architecture.
I went to Terrell Junior High School, and Terrell, although it was an incredible experience, 7th, 8th grade, 9th grade, wonderful time in my life. Wouldn't want to go back there, but it was a wonderful time in my life. But I realized it was, I wanted something more different. I was always interested in architecture. And I found out that McKinley High School, unlike Dunbar, had certain programs, something like a pre-med, pre-engineering, pre-architecture, pre-art, and music, in music. And so I went there because of their pre-architecture program.
But how does a young black boy get interested in architecture?
I'd taken mechanical drawing in seventh grade, and there was something about the sense of mechanical drawing that just completely resonated with me. It was the perfect combination between math and art, because there's a lot of geometry in mechanical drawing. And it was very neat, it was very clean, it was very precise. And I've always been interested in buildings and construction. And so architecture just seemed to be the right thing. So when I found out about McKinley having a program in architectural drawing, I was very intrigued. I applied, I was accepted, it worked. And I realized that the whole process of architecture was exactly what I really enjoyed. I would routinely wear a tie
to school,
just to school, because you sort of get into the zone of being an architect.
Black instructors?
Yes. Oliver Stover was my architecture, well, mechanical drawing, then architectural drafting instructor. And he was very pedantic. He was very hard to please. He was someone that you had to get it precise, or he would draw circles around the corners if they were just a millimeter off. So he was very precise. So if you could do well, and I remember I had this very intricate mechanical drawing project that I had to do, and I spent a lot of time on it, and I just wasn't sure how it was. Quite frankly, I didn't think the guy could be pleased at all. I got an A.
Wow.
And that was motivation enough for me to, it gave me the confidence to know that I could, this was something that I was, that was in my wheelhouse. And did that for 3 years, applied to many schools of architecture up and down the East Coast. And I decided, once I got the acceptance from Howard, why leave town? And so I went there on the 5-year architecture program, and it was probably, without a doubt, one of the best programs around.
In 1977, Cardell Richardson entered the military, where he used those architectural skills. He talked about the leadership opportunities he gained in the Air Force.
How did you feel being a captain in the Air Force? This had been your goal. What was it like when you achieved it?
Oh, it's incredible, because you get a tremendous amount of leadership responsibilities and opportunities, but you get a lot of opportunities to just to do your craft. I was a base architect down in Texas. Then I moved to another position where I was doing building energy audits, and you know, as a captain, depending on captain in Korea, and I had a huge responsibility for all the environmental engineering. Subsequent to that, went to Andrews Air Force Base, where I actually ran a huge engineering division. So I learned, I was given a lot of responsibility, but given a lot of opportunities, and but you're given a lot of opportunity to develop confidence in what you can do.
So your family lived around the world. What's that been like for you?
Yeah, that's been incredible. I've lived in Korea, We whole family, we've lived in Europe. We lived in Germany, but traveled all over Europe. And what it's shown us is that people are, as much as we are different, we're more alike than we are different. And it really, there's a sort of a basic to all people, and that is, and we've had, you know, we've had neighbors all over, we lived all over the country, out in the Midwest, the Southwest, the East Coast, and we've learned that it really is important to just be considerate, treat people the way you would expect to be treated, and regardless of how bad you hear people are basically good. And I think if you look for the good in people, you'll find it. We've had assignments where we've only been there for a couple of years at a time. In the military, you make fast friends. And so that means you have to be a friend. And so we've had acquaintances that we've had for decades.
But despite long-term friendships, Cardell Richardson noted that there were also times he faced racial discrimination in the military.
The context is some of the situations that I may have had as a African American, as a black person, as a black officer in the Air Force, and I remember in many cases I would find myself in places where I was the only black officer, for that matter, only black person in an environment. I do remember when I was on a remote assignment to Republic of Korea, in South Korea. I was on an assignment there for a year, remote from my family. And we had a very specialized project to bed down this weapon system called F-16, and they needed certain, there were certain logistical requirements in bedding down this, or preparing for this weapon system to come into country. And as a civil engineer officer, I was responsible for going around to these various sites to make sure that it was set up accordingly. And I do remember meeting one officer who was of the majority race, a white person, who asked me, I'm there with two other individuals that are junior to me, and he was in the middle of telling us something that was classified, and he stopped and said, looked at me. Not the other individuals, said, are you cleared? And I just shook my head and said, yes, I am. But in my head, I was thinking, you only asked me. You didn't ask anyone else. That was common fare. And it was those kinds of things that happen on occasions by certain individuals that would give you pause, would give me pause. But likewise in the military, because incidentally, the military was, quite frankly, where race relationships was really, where it really matured. And the military set the standard for the rest of the, the rest of America, for the most part. So I have, you know, equal stories about individuals that saw someone who was working harder, doing better than his peers, and elevated me to officer of the quarter, officer of the year, who also happened to be someone of a different race.
In 2003, Cardell Richardson retired from the military after 26 years with the rank of colonel. He continued in federal service, working for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, where he previously was Director of Diversity Management and Equal Employment Opportunity, as well as Director of the agency's Installation Operations Office. He had contributed 41 years of government service at the time of his interview.
You've been recognized for some pretty significant achievements. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, I have. Most recently, it was a Presidential Rank Award. It's an award that's given to senior executives in the government, top 1%. I was told last year I was going to be nominated. That was an honor in itself, and I was good. But then in December, I was home on leave during the holidays, and I got a call from the director saying I was actually selected. So I was awarded the Presidential Rank Award under his current administration. But 8 years ago, 9 years ago, in 2009, President Barack Obama's administration, I was honored with the award the first time. And so I'm somewhat proud of that.
For what criteria are you selected? What puts you in that conversation?
It's a meritorious rank award for leadership, and it's a body of work. Then the first time it was for a body of work of over 6 years. For this time it's a body of work for over the last 9 years, as I mentioned, since I've been in this agency in a civilian capacity as a senior executive. I've had multiple opportunities, and I've actually had my fifth director. So it's not as if it was a single director that has recognized this. So at every opportunity I've been given, I've been blessed to be able to do a good job, a job that's considered, I guess, well enough by those that are certainly observing that I've been recognized for it. So I'm honored, I'm proud, I'm pleased, but I give a lot of credence to my team, but I give all the credit to God.
Like other Washingtonians, Cardell Richardson has observed the structural and demographic changes in his native city. He talked about the effects of gentrification on neighborhoods he'd known since his years growing up in Washington.
I routinely say if I hadn't grown up here and been here doing the transition, I routinely say if you dropped me out the sky and asked me where was I wouldn't have a clue, because it's so different from growing up where we had very low rise buildings, where development was very slow, where we had, especially after the riots of '68. Where we had vacant lots all over the place, just where business people would not invest. And kids growing up here had to make the best out of what they had. Also, when I think about some of the books we had in public school and the lack of really good Black history, because it was written by people who didn't know Black history. But I've seen an incredible change. A lot has changed. There's been a lot of development. You talk about gentrification. The demographic here in Washington, D.C. has changed immensely. I remember when purportedly, they were over 90. It was like 90% Black. I don't think that number is exactly what it was. I think it was something closer in the 70s. But I know now it's probably close to the 50s or less. But there's been a development explosion, where I remember walking from 5th and L Street Northeast to 11th and K Street Northwest. And as I mentioned, low-rise buildings, a lot of my friends that went to Terrell Junior High School and went on to Dunbar, they lived there. All of those are gone. Commerce has happened. That's all high-rise condos and high rent, I might add. We've seen the streets developed. For goodness sakes, the trolley car, which is just a novelty for a certain demographic that would have never been put there back when I was growing up, and it really was a chocolate city.
Can you contrast the youth experience that you had growing up to perhaps what your kids and what you're seeing for your grandkids right now?
Yes. When I was growing up, majority of I would say the larger population of blacks were not going to college. Something happened, I would say probably just about the time my wife and I were graduating high school. There was a real push, a realization, I would say a consciousness that said, if blacks were ever going to do anything, education was a must. And I saw more and more of my contemporaries going to college as I did. And previously, that was not the case.
They would go to the military?
They would generally go in the military. They would go immediately into the to work for Bell Atlantic or
government
or construction work. But most people didn't see themselves going to college, blue collar workers. And then at some point, that changed. I think the riots had a lot to do with it. That is where people were no longer waiting for opportunities, but they were pushing the edge of the envelope. If you remember in 64, it was Civil Rights Act was passed, and then in 65, the Voting Rights Act passed. And so I think a lot of that had to do with the progression. A lot of Martin Luther King's March on Washington for Equality. And I think, I think people like myself, my wife, my siblings, I think we were benefactors of that struggle quite a bit. So to contrast that, many of us also went to historically black universities and colleges. As I said, I went to Howard University. My wife went to Morgan. Most of my friends that I graduated college with went to places like Cheney State and Morehouse and places that were historically black universities, Howard University, as I mentioned. Fast forward to my kids, and after seeing the world and seeing what's out there, and we ironically wound up back here in Centerville, Virginia. Both of my kids graduated from Centerville High School, and both went to schools and went to school on scholarship. My son, athletic scholarship to Wake Forest, very wonderful small school, extremely well endowed. It's not a historically black university. My daughter could have gone virtually anywhere. She went on an academic scholarship, but she wound up going over to going out to Iowa State, predominantly white. Matter of fact, I think the African American population was 3%. And she went out there. It's a big school, it's like 20,000. She went out there on a scholarship for chemical engineering. And the point is, it proved that blacks can compete on any level, anywhere, with anyone. And I don't think we always knew that when I was coming up. And But thank God for historically black schools, because they always knew that, and it was certainly an opportunity to do well and to progress.
As Cardell Richardson has seen changes in his city and in opportunities for his family, he also sees a hopeful future for his church.
What do you think is the next chapter for Asbury?
You think about this. Asbury is almost as old as Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has only been here since 1790. Asbury has been here since 1836. So we're coming up on 200 years. And we've gone through a lot. I mean, just edifice alone is, we're on the third one. I expect it will still be there. But the point is, these are times have changed. They've been changing. They didn't just start. What's in the next chapter? I think as long as we continue to be a place where people can worship, as long as we can be a place where people, where we can serve, as long as we recognize our community and really provide service to that community, and as long as we're a faithful church, as long as we're a faithful church.
What does a faithful church feel like for you?
Putting God first, which means whatever we do, because, you know, Asbury, as we talk about it, I think as we think about it, we think about that gray structure on the corner of 11th and K Street. But the church is in each one of us. And I remember a young minister when we were out in Kansas, Tyrone Gordon, saying, sometimes you are the only... people will only see Christ when they see you. Sometimes you will be the only Bible anyone will ever read. So you have to present yourself as such. And they need to know that there's a grace of God in all of us, but it has to be exemplified in each one of us, which means the way I present myself. And then when I tell someone that I'm an Asbury and all of that, invite them to Asbury, they may be inclined to come because they see something that would draw them to that edifice. But each one of us is the church, and we can't be confused about that. And so I think when I say faithful, I think we have to put God first, and we have to have faith that if we're doing His will, Asbury will not just survive but thrive.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Asbury UMC DC Oral Histories, a podcast of Asbury United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. This podcast was made possible by a grant from the DC Oral History Collaborative, which is a partnership of Humanities DC, Historical Society of DC, and the DC Public Library. It was edited and produced by Adele Banks. The interviewer was Bandit Wright. I'm your host, Kelvin Childs. Please check out more about Asbury at asburyumcdc.org or on our Facebook page. You can find other episodes of this podcast on our website, our YouTube channel, and on various podcast platforms.